this week's episode, we have a mix of music and politics, life lessons, and the secrets of happiness, all from an interview with New Hampshireite Dan Parrish. Now, Dan Parrish can't tell you exactly what he does for a living. Back in the 1960s, he self-destructed during his PhD, leaving his stiff shirt upbringing behind.
I don't know if it was me blowing it out of proportion or what they really wanted, but I had the feeling that I was supposed to be a naval doctor, and that's about what I thought about all
that. Like they wanted you to cuckoo, join the military.
He stopped combing his hair, he grew a mustache, studied Japanese, and ended up in Mexico City playing flamenco guitar. He doesn't call himself a hippie, exactly. He was a late-blooming flower child, if he was one at all.
I was not a druggie. I had never done drugs. But I might as well have been, for my state of mind, because all that studying, all that pushing myself had put me in a state of mind where I was pretty, like they say, late in my loafers.
In the next hour, Dan talks about dropping out and about how he ended up as a young, well-educated New England Protestant in the strange world of flamenco in Mexico City.
People said, you're a gringo or you're an American, why do you like flamenco? And I say, well, I'm a Puritan. I grew up in the same sex and love-starved culture that the gypsies did, so I can really relate to this.
Dan also treats us with some flamenco songs, thus one of his own, as he explains how he's learned to squeeze the puritanical lemon, as he puts it.
My name is Dan Parrish, and born in 1938 in Boston, Massachusetts. But it wore off.
And what would you say your profession is?
Well, people used to ask me, what did I do? And I'd say, nothing. I want to help. But I've done all kinds of things. I was a professional student until I was in the late 20s and studied, got a bachelor's in philosophy, minoring in pre-med. And then I went to University of Chicago and studied sociology.
For a PhD?
Minoring in Japanese studies, and basically that was so I could survive. So I ended up studying more Japanese history and language than I did statistics, which was a much more interesting way of living. But I got what I call my ABD degree, which is all but dissertation.
So you never got a PhD formally?
No, I passed the exams at the PhD level, but I didn't do the dissertation. So. And I never bothered to finish my master's either, so I'm a bachelor. Irrevocably.
So what happened?
Just don't tell my wife.
So you just left school? What was the breaking point for you?
I basically self-destructed and left. I tried to go back a few times.
Is it all mental or are you physically?
I went
just
to Mexico for 6 months and came back and went to school. I was registered and convinced them to let me come back, and realized at the end of the semester I hadn't gone to any of the classes. I didn't even notice till it was the end. I mean, that was how far out I was. Well, I don't think I'm a student anymore.
Was this in the 1960s? Were you part of the era of love? Were you a hippie?
Not really. I mean, I was really enjoying the fact that people were getting so free around me. But I was raised as a kind of a stiff shirt. And I remember the first day in Chicago when I decided not to comb my hair. And that was really embarrassing. I figured everybody was looking at me. And that led to growing a mustache, and that all the gals said it would probably fall off, but what happened was it slid down around my chin instead.
This has been like 1966,
yeah,
67?
Right. And I remember I went to Mexico a total outcast for my hirsute decorations, and came back, and everybody had them, and they were all celebrities for them. And I thought, well, isn't this wonderful? I don't have to be apologetic anymore. So I suppose at that point you could have said a lot of people would have classified me as a hippie or a flower child or something.
Did you live that lifestyle?
But I wouldn't really want to give myself that much credit.
No?
I probably even lived a lot like that. But I was a late bloomer as a flower child. And I ended up living from the time I was, well, more and more as time went by, I became a worker in the arms of nature rather than a struggler in the flow of man's idea of work. Tried to be a farmer and had my own independent farm, which turned out to be kind of a failure, I'm afraid, but I had to do it for my own sake.
Was that in the 70s?
That was, I lose track. No, it was later because I was married to Kate. Don't ask me when we got married, but I can tell you it was 29 years ago or something like that. But before that, I'd been basically living in my car in Mexico or around New Hampshire in the woods, and maybe that went on for 10 years too. So. Depend who they were talking to, I guess. I think that they tried to present me to the public as a success, but I think they had difficulty with my approach to life. Eventually, I think they decided it was kind of interesting. But I think it was hard for them in the beginning.
Did they have high ambitions for you?
Yes, I think so. I don't know if it was me blowing it out of proportion or what they really wanted, but I had the feeling that I was supposed to be a naval doctor, and that's about what I thought about all that.
Like they wanted you to cuckoo, join the military.
Well, I thought that they wanted me to be that kind of really successful career man. That's why I did pre-med.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe I'd try to be a doctor, but I was just too restless to sign up for a program that long, you know. And if I'd known sociology was going to be all statistics, I would have probably done something else. University of Chicago was Duncan Strodbeck, whatever. Those were the professors who were in charge, and they were all very statistical.
And that wasn't your mindset?
No. When I read the catalog, they were talking about setting up your own program in the inner city, studying delinquency and stuff, and that made me go to University of Chicago. But when I got there, I found out that's not the way they handle it. They had you poring over population statistics and working on a card driven computer that filled a Grand Central Station. So yeah, it wasn't me.
Mm-hmm.
I really like people. I like being out talking to people and observing people, and that's what I was thinking I was going to do. So I ended up doing it anyway, just to get paid for it.
And when you were smaller, did you have any career ambitions, any specific ones?
No, I never. I was always kind of wondering what I wanted to be. I've always been somebody who was infatuated with beauty and to some justice and truth and all those non-profit organizations. So I was not a good person to ask to be a career.
So after you dropped out of university, you went to Mexico straight away?
That's kind of how I dropped out. I had a Japanese girlfriend, and she wanted to go. She was going home. She wanted to stop in Mexico, and she needed a bodyguard. And so she asked if I'd go with her. I was not a druggie. I had never done drugs. But I might as well have been for my state of mind, because all that studying, all that pushing myself had put me in a state of mind where I was pretty, like they say, late in my loafers.
Does that just mean kind of zonked or out of your mind? Or?
Just flighty, you know. Mm. But we went to Mexico. I got on the plane. I didn't know. Even though she had been studying Spanish in Berlitz for a couple of months, I somehow had no idea what language we were going to speak. That's how far out I was. And we got on a plane. We were going to Mexico. I didn't know if we had to cross an ocean. I didn't know where we were going. And I'm a sociologist. How about that? God.
You're like 25 years old, or how old are you at this point?
I was 28 or mm-hmm. 9, so I should have known better. Mexico really saved my life. I ended up staying there for about 7 months on a 6-month visa and just sitting in a guitar shop. They basically took care of me and did work on guitars and gradually pieced myself back together.
So was that when you started playing flamenco guitar when you were in Mexico?
I started playing, and I think that was the beginning of the end of my incredibly effort to be a career person. The same lady, my Japanese girlfriend, accompanied me because I decided I wanted to learn to play a musical instrument to somehow cling to my sanity, what was left of it. I was kind of a musical snob. I didn't want to do some kind of folk music, you know, that was beneath me. So. And I didn't really want to do the discipline of some heavy-duty classical instrument. And somehow I had the misconception that classical guitar might lie somewhere in the middle. And so I went to this guitar studio and started learning how to play classical guitar. I had been trying to learn a piece on the guitar called Clair de Lune for a year. And gotten so I could play it, but it sounded so terrible, I thought it was about time that I took some lessons. And my Japanese girlfriend went with me, but she was a lot smarter than I was. She thought she wasn't going to be able to keep up with the discipline of classical guitar, so she decided to study flamenco guitar. And I liked what she was studying so much more than what I was studying that I ended up practicing her stuff instead.
The flamenco. What appealed to you?
That got me into it, the rhythms and the harmonies, the chords.
Can you play us just a little bit?
Well, yeah,
flamenco,
I can.
Give a taste. Or maybe first you could play some of Clair de Lune.
No, I can't remember.
You
that,
can't remember any? After a year?
No, that was 50 years ago or something.
Oh, okay. So no Clair de Lune?
Clair de Lune is not clear anymore.
Then flamenco then.
Well, the piece that I learned and kind of just sat around and poked at for about a year and listened to records and tried to get it off records, because I only saw a couple of her class She took a couple glasses and left. So. It's called Farruka. It's got, it takes a certain lilt to get that to come out right. And it's a flamenco dance. And it's 4/4 time. Took me literally a year to digest. I tried to play it, didn't sound like it, and I wanted to be able to just play it from me instead of copying it from something else. And I mean, if we had time, I could. It's interesting to me, but perhaps not for this particular interview. But the subtlety of the rhythm took a long time to grasp.
You hadn't grown up listening to this kind of music.
Oh, I never heard it before in my life. People said, "You're a gringo or you're an American, why do you like flamenco?" And I say, "Well, I'm a Puritan. I grew up in the same sex and love starved culture that the gypsies did, so I can really relate to this."
You're a gypsy born into a Puritan family?
Well, you don't have to be a gypsy. All you have to do is a Puritan, and your soul gets pinched enough so you can really understand why they're belly aching, you know.
So you didn't get bored over that year playing the piece?
No. It's like food. Mm-hmm. And people say, "How can you stand it? It must have taken a lot of discipline." I said, "No, I just love doing it." And I've never stopped loving doing that. It's something. I mean, the only reason I quit was after I worked in nightclubs. It was so impassioned that I was just totally wearing myself out, and I had to take a break. But it wasn't because I didn't love it.
So, can you describe the scene that you were playing in Mexico City? It was Mexico City.
I played mainly in Mexico City in nightclubs. And I played for different kinds of, always a dance team and usually a singer. And depending on who I was playing for, it was freer or more routinized. There was one couple, Martin and Raquel, I won't say anymore because I don't want anybody to get hurt, but they had to have their routine. And if I missed one beat, it completely threw them off. So I had to have exactly the same thing every night.
They were the dancers. Yeah.
They were the dancers. And some of the singers were that way too. I had to make sure I played just the right accompaniment for them. And flamenco singing is different from popular singing in the sense that a lot of times the progression of chords is going kind of against the melody. Mm-hmm. It's creating a dissonance in itself. It's very interesting that way. But even so, you had to do exactly right or they get lost. And so sometimes I feel kind of like a drummer, you know, just beating out rhythms. I had strings on my drum, but it was still just a drum. But sometimes I get to play for guys who were freer. And those guys, you just played and you bounced off them, was like jazz, and that was really great.
So it wasn't like you were part of a standard group or a set?
Well, I established myself in Mexico City by playing with a certain, that Martin and Raquel.
And you'd be the only,
I was the only guitarist with them. They hired me, that's how I got my papers, they wanted me to play for them. Mm-hmm. So.
How did they come across you?
I used to play and dance for dance classes all around town. There were about four or five flamenco dance studios, and I just go around and play for classes, and somehow they heard of me, and they liked, like Martin said, he says, he's not really the greatest flamenco guitarist, but he adapts to what I want to have done.
So he followed her orders?
And so, yeah, so I was good at following orders, but that was fine because I was so excited about being able to play that it didn't matter what reason they had for saying come along. We went, actually traveled around Mexico and played in different places.
Really, all kinds of cities.
And we went as far as Tijuana, actually. Played in a nightclub there. I remember one night was more exciting than the rest because the guy liked to. Music so much he shot a few holes in the ceiling.
And so what's going on in these nightclubs? Is everybody dancing or everybody
no,
sitting
at the
tables?
No, it's drinking and sitting around and impressing their girls. It's like most bars.
Mm-hmm.
They don't dance because flamenco isn't a kind of dance thing that you can dance to. It's a thing that it's a. We were a show, you know.
And what kind of clientele would you say, like high class, low class, fancily dressed people?
Oh, very often the clubs had people who had a lot of money. You know, that could be different from high class.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a way that they could impress their business associates or their ladies or, you know. They would know. They know all about flamenco, and they'd sit there and they'd clap. And of course, it was way off the rhythm, but it didn't matter. They were looking like they were really good at it. So,
and, what's
and
the
then they'd tip, oh. You know, big tips. So.
But what's the reputation for flamenco? What kind of mood or what are the associations with flamenco music and dancing?
Well, it's a fiery kind of music, as you know, so my impression is that it had prestige. You know, Mexicans don't like flamenco music any more than Spaniards do. It's the music of the gypsies of southern Spain. And it's got a lot of passion and energy, and people are drawn to that, you know. Because a lot of people are wishing they had some themselves, you know? And so Mexicans are drawn to it just the way anybody else. And of course, in bigger cities, we were playing for tourists a lot. But the Americans, not too many Mexicans really. Mexican music is beautiful, but it's a different kind of thing. And most Mexicans like that kind of music more than flamenco.
Mm-hmm.
So the nightclubs where they had flamenco were touristic places that were frequented by foreigners or Mexicans with money, I would say, mainly. Or a very sparse collection of aficionados, you know, Mexicans, people who just love flamenco. Well, that happens too, you know. That was the fun part. You get some of these guys would come in and we'd sit around afterwards and we'd get drunk and play music, and that was fun.
Well, could you play maybe another piece? Like a piece that you would have played in Mexico?
Well, what I'll do is I'll see if I can play something that I just happen to like a lot.
Yeah. Thank you. What's the name of that, or is there a name?
It's called Soleares. It's a romantic. It's kind of there. Falls into the category of requited love, I would think. Unfortunately, it's hard to play cold like that. I sort of felt bad for whoever's listening, because a flamenco can sound a lot better than that. But that's a soleares, and it works into, as you go faster, it works into a rhythm that they call bulerías, which just means party time, sort of, and that's a loose translation, means burla, means to kind of make fun of, and I don't know if that's where the name came from, because a lot of these names are gypsy names, Romani names, and I'm not sufficiently educated to know exactly the origins of the words. But it is the fun party side of flamenco, which everybody really loves. There was a movie with Antonio Banderas, and he walked around with a machine gun in his guitar case or something. But anyway, that I think that they played a lot of bulerías in that movie.
So, was there a lot of money and competition in the Mexico City flamenco scene? Was there a career there that for you?
No. No, it's more something I did because I loved it. It's like any artistic scene. If you become among the 2% that actually is a celebrity, then you can be perhaps get some money. But if you're just the workhorse, everyday artist, you don't get anything.
And the people around you,
I only did it for 1 year because at the end of the year I realized that I paid more for my permit than I got earned for the year, so it really wasn't a really good deal.
And the music and the scene wasn't enough to make
I kept going, but at that time, I was all burned out, so I went back to the States and I did a lot of other things for quite a few years. It's only recently that I've been getting back into flamenco and feeling like I had the psychic strength to go back and enjoy it. And I really do enjoy it now, but I don't tend to lose myself quite as completely as I used to. I kind of pull my punch a little, so I have some energy left.
Do you know what happened to the people you used to play with in Mexico?
Well, it was funny because I went back after 10 years and all but I think two of the guitarists I'd been playing with were dead.
How did they die? Were they old?
Well, one died in a plane crash. He was going with a troop to, I think, Cuba in a small plane. They never found anything. A couple of them died of, I think, drug-related, stress-related, maybe drug completely overdose, or just their bodies broke down under the strains of not taking care of their bodies.
Do you think that was common among musicians in the scene, just drug use and not?
Well, I didn't really know any other musical scenes, but rumor has it that rock stars can have that kind of a fate. I just know that in the amongst the guitarists that I had known, I went back and they were dead, which was a total surprise. But I kind of thought maybe I'd been smart to back off. That's just not a very solid sociological observation. But they were. It was too bad. But and a lot of the dancers weren't around either.
What happened to them?
Some of them were dead, and some of them just actually managed to go to other places, maybe going to Spain or something. Because Mexico, flamenco, it has kind of lost its popularity in Mexico, I'd say. Right now, there's only about two clubs really. There's not much of an atmosphere. I used to find, little puddles of gypsyhood all over the place, and I don't find it so much now.
You say puddles of gypsyhood?
Yeah.
Do you mean puddles of gypsyhood?
Well, there were little groups here and there of either Mexicans or actual gypsies. Mm-hmm. You might have heard of a dancer who was called Carmen Amaya. She was very famous in the early part of, before the 50s, I think. She was a fabulous flamenco dancer, pure gypsy. Her sister lived in Mexico City. She was dead, but Leonor, her sister, and I guess there was a couple other members of her family that lived there, and I kind of hung around with those guys. And they were all just living, breathing, eating flamenco, and there was a some other, there was one family who were kind of, I think they were basically indigenous, you know, Mexicans, but they had somehow poured their whole lives into flamenco, and they earned their money by making very, very elaborate costumes for the toreadors. And they were always in, totally involved in that atmosphere, you know, the bullfights and the flamenco. And if you went to their house, there was always somebody sitting there strumming a guitar, playing some piece, or there was always somebody yodeling, or there was somebody trying to figure out a dance step, or, you know, it was just constant flamenco stuff, and that was really amazing. But that's hard to find now. I have one friend down in Mexico City who I go and see, and she's a really good flamenco dancer, but she doesn't work professionally anymore. And so we, I always go there and I'll play stuff and she'll dance, and maybe we'll go and visit people who are friends who do stuff. But the expanse of the enthusiasm is not the same, unfortunately. But that doesn't matter to me. I just do it for myself. If I have any geographical home, it's New Hampshire. That's where my mother's family lived. And there's a small town called Dublin. And that's kind of like Peyton Place, really. I think it's pretty well ingrown. And my mother's family is a dominant factor in that community.
So is there any flamenco there, or you're the...
No, not at all.
You're the sole...
No, but my mother's great-grandfather was really quite a well-known artist, painter, a portrait painter, and then my grandfather was also a very credible painter, but not with the same enormous reputation. My great-grandfather has pictures in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and...
What was his name?
In George Zafar's brush. And he has pictures in the Chicago Museum of Art, and he has pictures in the Smithsonian. He definitely was a major artist of his time. Not that I could care less, but I'm just saying that I had this kind of what I call autistic background. Well, you have to say it that way, you know, if you're high class.
Oh. So it is artistic, who just pronounced
it. Yeah, there you go. So this clock knows just how to punctuate.
But otherwise, do you play up in New Hampshire? You said you started playing.
Well,
in
the last few years, I got into playing... writing songs of my own. That's been quite an exciting challenge. I think that's even more fun than flamenco in a way. It's more of me coming out. It's not just squeezing the puritanical lemon. It's I get a chance to talk about other things.
What do is a puritanical lemon. Can you explain that concept just a little bit?
One of my obscure references. Well, I'm just saying that the sorrow or the deep pain in your life, flamenco helped me to deal with those things. It was kind of therapeutic, and it's really effective for desahoguing, getting rid of this stuff, you know, spitting it all out. Writing songs, it's funny, most of the songs I write, I don't even know who writes them. They talk about things that I have no knowledge of or feelings that I really haven't thought about. It's kind of embarrassing sometimes, but it's kind of refreshing to let somebody else do the talking. I tell people I'm surrounded by mischievous muses. And I'm going to give them all the blame for whatever comes out.
Not in control. Well, do you want to play one of your songs or anything you've been working on recently?
Well, you know, I could give you a try and see. I'm one of these people who, well, I need to see the words, or otherwise I forget. I was very comforted because I always thought, kind of embarrassed by the fact that I had to look at my sheet music in order to remember the words.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't I remember the words to my own songs? I don't know. But I noticed that Johnny Cash did that too, so I said, well, okay. Maybe we're not, maybe senility runs in the family. Let me see if I can remember this one. This, if I can manage this. This song is called Liebchen, which implies that it's something German, but it has nothing to do with that. It was just that the sound of the word combined two words in the song. One was loving and the other was liking. And so I just called it Liebchen, which means sweetheart, so it's fair enough. Cause I hope you mean it like when you say you're loving me. Just cause you're a looker don't give love a guarantee. You gotta be a liker, not a lover wanna be. Loving and the liking are an unlikely pair. Loving takes a looking when the liking isn't there. Mom always told me that I'd never have to fret. As long as I was given, that's what I would get. The best way of giving is doing what you love. It's stupid to be stupid to the world to push and shove. Loving and liking are an unlikely pair. Loving takes a licking. It takes a lot of liking to work it all out. I love to be liked and I like to be loved, but I'd rather be liked than all of the above. Loving and liking are an unlikely pair. Loving takes a licking when the liking isn't there. So when you say when you say you're loving me.
Very nice. Is that very recent?
No, it's been around for a while, but it's one of those muses that said something that made sense. So.
And do you ever play in public? Or?
I do the best I can, yeah.
Around New Hampshire somewhere?
Yeah, open mics. I've played on the radio a couple of times. I got political occasionally, so I advertised with my songs on the radio. But and sneak in a couple of other songs.
And do you get a buzz off it the same way flamenco gave you a buzz?
Oh, it's... I think I get more of a buzz. Like I say, it's more... it encompasses a wider range of feelings, you know? So, I mean, every one of my songs says something kind of different, I think. They're all love songs.
Mm-hmm.
But love is a many splendored event. So that gives me a lot of chances. And I really am a much happier person than I used to be, and so my songs express more of the enjoyment I have, you know. And the silliness I feel, whereas flamenco is kind of serious, you know.
It's a different music for different stages.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any?
But there still is, like, I mean, that Soleadas I played really was too stiff and not really expressing myself. But sometimes my flamenco really, I can really be joking around, and have fun with it, you know. So I can, but it's no words in it, so. Unless you really pay attention, you might not understand the jokes. But people like words, I think. It's like pictures. They like something that they can recognize. You know.
Do you have any big ambitions for your music in the future? Any?
Well, if I were to make some kind of... establish some kind of rather frightening goal, I would love it if, for some strange reason, somebody really liked my song and it became... something that everybody was enjoying, that would be a real sense of satisfaction, you know. But the truth is, I've been doing it for me, and if for some reason somebody else likes it, I'm so happy. But I think that it's almost the process is the satisfaction, you know. It'd be wonderful to be able to have a little bit more job security. So. For some reasons, when I actually got money for a song sometime or other, that would be even nicer. But I've never been particularly focused on job security as my goal in life. And fortunately, I married somebody who forgives me for that. And my parents, I think, began to... My mother was an artist, so she... really couldn't throw too many stones. And my father was a very sensitive, gentle soul, and I think somehow he was glad that somebody was doing something creative instead of just bringing home another dollar bill. But still. So my ambitions are not particularly laudable, I guess. I do it for fun. I think life is really, that's the... frivolous as it sounds, I think that's got to be the most important thing, is being a happy person and hopefully bringing some happiness to the people around you. And of course, that's never something you can do all the time, but I think it's the only thing that makes any sense to me. And I think, you know, bringing home money and the power to get what you need is one way of helping people to be happy, and bringing them new ideas and inspirations might be another. And sometimes those two things don't necessarily come in the same package. So I'm hoping that in my life that I'm bringing some inspiration to the people around me. That would be perhaps my ambition. I think maybe that comes down to it more than whatever my music means, you know. I would feel very happy if I thought, I think my life would be worthwhile if I thought somebody got inspired by whatever silly things I did. That'd be great. And I don't know where this, if this interview gets aired. I'm not sure where it will be, but
Belfast.
To all of you good people out there, I wish you well.
And that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thanks to Dan Parrish for the interview and for the music today. We'll be here next week with another interview. But until then, I'm Margaret Hagen, and this has been Another World.